and welcome to this week's edition of the Talking Newspaper, of course covering St Albans, Harpenden and all the surrounding areas. This is the programme for the 14th of January 2022, a fact which makes me realise we're already halfway through the first month of a new year. So if I was to say Happy New Year now, it would be a bit tardy. Anyway, I hope you had a good Christmas and that the new year was okay as well. I've chosen some music today which is called Blue Skies. It's by Goffby, our good friend Goffby. And I suppose I chose it really for two reasons. One, because it's nice and gentle. And yet, because also the title is optimistic. And I'm not just talking about the weather. We may get some blue skies this week. It's either fog, rain or blue skies. We've got a choice. But it's really because it's an optimistic title for the way we go into a new year. We've had a pretty difficult last couple of years. And I think we need a bit more of the blue sky, not just blue sky thinking, but blue sky enjoying. We need some gentleness and we need some optimism. Right, let's get into our programme for this week. I'll give you the agenda, if you like, or the menu. First of all, of course, as ever, we will start with some news items from the Hearts Advertiser. News has been a bit thin on the ground in the last few editions, and I think it's partly because it was the festive season, depths of winter, not much happens. But also maybe COVID has stopped lots of events and so there are fewer things to report. And of course, it's quite a difficult time for local newspapers across the country. We're glad that ours is still going and we hope that it keeps going for many, many years. And of course, as well as the news, we've also got our regular feature, Radio Listings, kindly recorded by John. And this week's selection was made by Terry. We also have some suggestions for television programmes that have audio description that you might not be aware of and that you might enjoy with that extra facility. Then I'll bring you another regular feature, some events in history, things that have happened in this particular week at some time in the past, recent or a long distant. Then I've got a couple of features from what's called TNF Soundings. This is where material is put up into a website by different talking newspapers and then we can all use them. We put our own material up there like the radio listings and nature notes and various other things and that they're used across the country as well. So I've taken two that I'm particularly interested in and I've talked about Andrea Bocelli before, this wonderful blind tenor Italian chap who's got a fantastic voice. He started really in opera, but he's become a very famous worldwide singer of all sorts of romantic, dramatic, and operatic songs. Anyway, there's a piece coming up about his life, and it's sort of biographical, I suppose. And I'm following that by another biography of a writer that I've enjoyed very much over many decades, James Joyce. He's not everybody's taste, and he's pretty difficult to read, but it's quite interesting hearing something about his life, because he was a very interesting man, and he has a lot of very interesting works that he left behind him when he passed on long ago. Then I'm back again after that with the feature on people whose birthdays occur this week, famous people, people that are alive now or people that were alive in previous times. These two items, the birthdays which I've recorded and the events, are both written and supplied to us by a volunteer at the Stevenage Talking Newspaper. Then I will offer you the exercise class that Ian brought last week. We were repeating it after the first time it's heard so that you get two goes at it. And what we're going to do at the end, we can't do it yet because we haven't got them all, but as they're released week after week, we store them. We're going to make them available to any listener who would like to have the whole set to have forever and ever and ever and keep going, keep getting fit carefully through the winter into the spring. And it won't be long before summer. After that, I'll play the piece of music that I started the programme with in full, and that will be the end of this programme. But before we get to the end, we got to get to the start. And the start, of course, is the news brought to us by our four readers this week, and they are Alison, Claire, Lizanne and Karen.
Plea to help pupils reach school safety. A pedestrian crossing needs to be installed outside a St Albans secondary school before someone is killed. This is the stark warning from Nicholas Breakspear head teacher Declan Ninane in the wake of increased traffic using Colney Heath Lane. Over the few years, and with the increase of pupil numbers from St Albans, The traffic using Colney Heath Lane is becoming a concern due to the speed and increase in traffic. This week we have had another near miss. A few years ago, one of my students was knocked over by a van, causing injury and missing time off school whilst she recovered. I have spoken to John Hale, our county councillor, who says he is trying to get a crossing, but this is taking too long. When speaking to him at the time, he explained that a crossing costs in the region of £40,000. I do hope that the county council are not waiting for a fatality before we get a crossing. His comments are echoed by one of the school's parents, whose son attends Nicholas Breakspear School. With the growing number of students at the school and COVID issues, I see more than 100 students crossing the road at the end of each day, and this is only the front entrance. I'm not aware of any other secondary school that doesn't have safe options to cross outside with either a pelican or zebra crossing. I appreciate our situation is different to others. My son would love to walk to school independently, and this is possible up until the last 100 metres with safe crossings. However, the speed of vehicles outside school, volume of traffic and his processing issues means he cannot cross the road safely without assistance. Councillor John Hale is trying to help. I support the head teacher's call for a pedestrian crossing outside the school, as there have been too many accidents and near misses at this location. I have asked the officers at the county council to assess the best solution so as to provide a safe crossing place.
Hello, this is Alison. My first story has the headline, Hashtag St Albans Cyclists Campaign aims to tackle inconsiderate bike riders in city centre. A St Albans resident has launched a one-man social media campaign to publicly shame irresponsible cyclists. Gerald Quinlan, who actually rides a bike himself, has posted dozens of images of antisocial and dangerous cycling in the city centre using the hashtag St Albans Cyclists on Twitter. He was prompted to take action after being frequently threatened with violence when he challenged cyclists about their behaviour, which often involves using pavement areas and dodging between pedestrians. One fellow snatched my telephone and twisted my wrist in the process and threatened to destroy it unless I deleted images of him nearly running me over. I remain disappointed that many of our local cycling groups and organisations have not tried to address this issue. Having said that, Verulam Cycle Club could not have been more helpful when I reported one of their members for abusing me. He received a verbal warning and they were very clear about the conduct they expected from members. Herts County Council has devised four different projects for St Albans to create safer, user-friendly spaces for those that cycle and walk after being awarded £6.4 million from the government's Active Travel Fund. But Gerald is concerned that these will increase the amount of irresponsible cycling in the city centre. Gerald added, "Cyclists in the city centre are now treating footpaths as if they were cycle lanes, yet the council has done nothing to tackle this menace. Clearly, robust measures are required to ensure that such antisocial and dangerous behaviour is not replicated on any walking routes. What would I like to happen? Simple. Cyclists to stop behaving in a dangerous and antisocial manner. I suppose the question is now, how can we stop this behaviour? Hopefully these suggestions are food for thought. A campaign for considerate cycling and a code of conduct for such, getting local cycling groups and organisations to sign up to such a code and making it a prerequisite for membership. Appropriate signage for no cycling on pavements and so on. Advertising and the use of social media to reinforce where cycling is inappropriate or illegal. Enforcement and having the council commit to ensuring that the wider community and not just the cycle lobby is involved in any cycling and walking working groups." And the piece is accompanied by four photographs taken by Mr. Quinlan demonstrating the dangerous cycling that he is talking about, mostly with cyclists on the pavement.
Hello, this is Claire reading today. My first article is about the St Albans Antique Market, and it's called Sunday Vintage Markets Saved by District Council. One of St Albans' popular Sunday markets has been saved from cancellation at the 11th hour. As revealed in the Hearts ad, the vintage markets were axed with just a few weeks' notice, by managers from St Albans BID, which stands for Business Improvements District, despite written confirmation that they would be going ahead. BID Chair Alison Benai initially blamed resources, the spread of Omicron, the winter weather and health and safety issues surrounding traders and gazebos, adding that all markets had been placed on hold while the BID was going through a renewal process. But she later backtracked on this statement, placing the responsibility with St Albans District Council and the reopening of city centre roads, which had been closed since the end of the first COVID lockdown. Last month, a decision was made to temporarily reopen High Street and George Street in advance of extensive pedestrianisation trials in April, which has reduced the amount of space available for BID markets, including those on Sundays and Fridays. St Albans District Council denied they had anything to do with the cancellation and this week stepped in to save the day. Local resident Jenny Titmus of Corky Events, who runs the Vintage Market, thanked the Hearts ad for covering the crisis. She said, "The response in support of the market has totally overwhelmed me and I love that the voice of the people can be heard when they shout loud enough." James Noonan, the new market manager, has confirmed that St Albans District Council Chief Exec Amanda Foley has signed off the continuation of the market for the time being until we can come up with a more permanent solution. So we will be going ahead this Sunday. To be clear, the BID have played no hand in sorting this out, and when I had a meeting with Alison Benai this week, she didn't even know that St Albans District Council was sorting it out for me. A St Albans District Council spokesperson said, "We are pleased the next three planned vintage and antique markets will go ahead following our discussions with one of the organisers and St Albans BID. A new temporary location has been agreed as some city centre areas are no longer pedestrianised and we will help with planning for the long term." The article is accompanied by an image of a busy market day.
Hello, I'm Lisanne Elvers. What's happening to the Alban Arena? After just 50 years, the arena has reached the end of its life, or has it? The District Council has a plan to demolish it, replace it with a commercial building, and build a new theatre behind the council offices along Brickett Road. The Civic Society is assessing this proposal and the alternative that the arena should be retained, remodelled and substantially upgraded. It has identified some questions which, when answered, will help it reach a view on whether or not to support the proposal. Because the future of the arena is a matter for the whole city, we thought these questions would be of interest to the wider community. 1. What sort of theatre do we want? Councillor Robert Donald has said we want to revitalise our cultural facilities to offer a wider range of performing arts, music, theatre and art indoors and outside. This is very welcome, but what will be the layout of the proposed theatre? The arena can be configured in very different ways, as an auditorium and stage, as a cabaret venue to provide a more relaxed environment, and as a completely flatbed open space for dance, exhibitions and walk-around experiences. How important is it that St Albans can still put on events as diverse as a model railway exhibition and a beer festival? Without the arena as an adaptable space, where else could we offer our own version of Strictly? If we think it is important to cater for a diverse range of tastes and interests, then the design of the space must reflect this. 2. Which course of action will impact most on climate change, building a new theatre or remodelling the arena? This will be a complex calculation, which again will have to be assessed for its accuracy. The calculation will have to estimate the demolition and construction costs for a new theatre against the cost of remodelling the arena, together with the running costs for both. Demolition is inherently unfriendly from an environmental perspective. About 11% of energy-related carbon emissions come from the construction of buildings, so the energy efficiency of a new build would have to be very high in order to compete with a retrofitted arena. 3. What heritage issues are there? If you are wondering why we are raising heritage for a building only just over 50 years old, then the reason is that the arena is locally listed by the council. The reason for its listing is that it was designed by Sir Frederick Gibberd, one of the foremost architects of his generation. Four of his buildings are nationally listed, one within his lifetime, a rare recognition of his importance. With the arena, St Albans has been touched by greatness. 4. Where should a theatre be located? Should the theatre be placed against Brickett Road or close to St Peter's Street? The issue for St Albans to decide is whether a commercial building will be better than an upgraded arena at supporting the vitality and viability of the city centre. Your views are important. Please make sure that your councillors know what you think by writing to the Advertiser and by emailing the Civic Society at stalbanscivicsociety@gmail.com. And this article was written by Peter Newby for Civic Society Committee, www.stalbanscivicsociety.com.
Owner of Popular Deli has withheld £25,000 in rent over roof row with council. The owner of one of St Albans' most popular cafes is withholding more than £25,000 in rent from his landlord in a dispute over a leaky roof. Gels Picciuto claims that leaks at the Smokehouse Deli cost him thousands of pounds in damage and lost earnings. The building is owned by St Albans District Council and its insurers have blamed condensation and refused to pay out. However, the businessman has now used the Freedom of Information Act to obtain two previously unseen reports, which he said proved the council had covered up problems with his building. The council sells you an insurance policy that you can't claim against and then tries to exhaust you, so you just give up, he alleged. But I can't give up, because if I do, I lose my investment and everything I have worked for. The deli is the best reviewed St Albans cafe on TripAdvisor, he pointed out. I should be able to sell this business and its goodwill quite easily, he said, but I can't, because I would have to declare the problems with the building and the problems with the landlord. SADC declined to comment. Mr Picciuto opened the Smokehouse Deli in a row of shops underneath a block of flats in Selbarns Lane on December 12, 2014. Just 4 days later, he said, he arrived to find the walls and ceilings soaking wet. Another 4 days later, it happened again, but this time he said the floor was flooded too. He claimed the incidents cost him thousands of pounds in busted equipment and ruined stock. He also had to completely redecorate for the second time in a month. A report by a forensic accountant suggested that the loss to Mr. Picciuto's business in damage and lost properties was over £160,000, but insurers wouldn't pay him a penny. In 2015, Mr. Picciuto hired the Mellersh and Harding Building Consultancy, whose inspection found that, quote, the only plausible explanation for the incidents was that the roof had leaked in several locations. But surveyors acting for St Albans Council's insurance company disagreed, saying there were, quote, few indications of water ingress or severe condensation, but some indications of slight or moderate condensation, end quote. Under the policy, said Mr Picciuto, condensation was an uninsurable loss. Dissatisfied, he continued to pursue complaints against the council. In October 2019, the council agreed to provide Mr Picciuto with a document certifying that the terrace roof above his unit met all building regulations. In a letter the following month, Chief Executive Amanda Foley wrote that, quote, no further investigation is required. The council is not prepared to enter into further discussion regarding these works, end quote. So Mr Picciuto was surprised months later in 2020 when he asked a surveyor to inspect his premises and act as an expert witness, only to be told that the surveyor could not accept his case because they had just been hired by the council to investigate the same building. It was like divine intervention, he said, a sheer stroke of luck. Mr. Picciuto started using Freedom of Information laws to search for copies of any expert reports the council had on his roof. This year, the council disclosed two. The first, written in May 2021 by Langley Roofing Systems, said the building's roofs were, quote, in poor condition and in urgent need of repair, end quote. It found large areas of standing water and various defects in the main roof area where insulation was, quote, found to be floating beneath the waterproofing with high levels of water ingress, end quote. The lower roof also had large areas of standing water and had, quote, deflected and bowed in areas possibly due to water ingress, end quote. The second report, written in September 21 by David Carr Consulting, found evidence of water penetration through the high-level roof in multiple places. Quote, "If the roof is left and the leaks into the building continue, there will be a problem with rusting reinforcement. And if this is allowed to deteriorate to any extent, expensive concrete repairs will be required." End quote. The company also found evidence of water penetration on the lower roof where water was ponding and timbers were rotting. Mr. Picciuto said he felt vindicated by the report. "This whole thing has really affected my mental health," he said. He said he would continue withholding his rent, which he has been doing since 2019, until the council accepted fault. The council would not comment.
This news article is entitled Car Crash. Yet another serious car crash took place on the notorious Redbourne Road yesterday afternoon. Police were called at around 5:50 p.m. on Sunday, January the 9th, following the incident. The two-car collision between a Vauxhall Corsa and a Vauxhall Insignia occurred near the Garden House and left the road blocked for some time. One person was taken to hospital before being released and taken into police custody. A 56-year-old man from Watford has been charged with driving while over the prescribed alcohol limit and has been bailed to appear before St Albans Magistrates Court on February the 11th. Redbourne Road has been the scene of numerous serious accidents and fatalities. Most recently, Gillian Williams and Tony Southwood died after being involved in a collision on October the 9th, 2019. A fatal accident also occurred on December the 15th, 2016, with a man in his 40s declared dead at the junction with Verulam Road and Hempstead Road.
My next article is about new tennis and netball courts in a St Albans park. Plans to replace sports facilities in the St Albans park have finally been given the green light almost 2 years after the courts were closed. New tennis and netball courts will be built alongside Abbey View Golf and Track 2 years after previous courts were converted into a children's play area. St Albans District Council's Cabinet approved plans to replace the courts in December 2020, with planning permission finally granted on January 10th. The new facilities will be built between the athletic track and car park on currently unused land in Verulamian Park. Councillor Chris Davies, who chaired the committee, said the loss of the original tennis courts was a big loss for his constituents, adding, "It's great to see this start to come to fruition." The work will not affect the trees that are already in place in the park or affect paths throughout the park for dog walkers. The District Council's conservation officers noted Verulamian Park is an extremely sensitive site in terms of heritage assets, but said the scheme was considered acceptable as long as there is additional planting to screen the courts. A condition to limit use of the 8-metre tall floodlights up to 8 p.m. on weekdays and 10 p.m. on weekends has also been included. Council officers agreed that the less than substantial harm on the conservation area was outweighed by the benefits of the scheme, including making sport more accessible for the community. Councillor Liz Needham raised concerns about the risk of flooding in the park, but officers reassured members of the committee that robust conditions had been put in place to mitigate the risks. A condition on the planning permission will also require work to remove a hedge to make space for the courts will be done out of the nesting season or after research has been done to ensure no harm is done to wildlife. Officers recommended the scheme for approval, with councillors on the planning committee unanimously backing the plans at Monday's meeting. And there is an image with this article which shows what the new courts will look like in the park.
Is there light at the end of COVID tunnel? St Albans MP Daisy Cooper looks back on a week in Westminster in her weekly political column. What did you get for Christmas this year? Sadly, even tragically in some cases, the answer for an estimated 3.7 million people was coronavirus. It's definitely good news that Omicron symptoms are less severe than other variants for most people, but this strain is still the most infectious and therefore it still poses a big collective threat, especially for our public services. As case numbers began to climb and so many people were forced to self-isolate, many sectors were feeling tremendous pressure even before Christmas. Railway services were running reduced or even further reduced services. NHS staff struggled to cover shifts for missing colleagues, and supermarket tills went unmanned. Now, with schools back and the full impact of holiday socialising only just starting to be seen in official numbers, the race is on to keep certain sectors moving and avoid important services from breaking down. To this end, the government has already brought in a few changes. You can now leave self-isolation after 7 days instead of 10, if you've had 2 consecutive days of negative lateral flow tests on day 6 and day 7. As of this week, you can also start the isolation period immediately after getting a positive lateral flow test, instead of waiting for a PCR test to confirm the result. However, these measures both rely on having ready access to lateral flow tests, which aren't always available. Recognising the risk from the test shortage, last week the government announced that 100,000 critical workers in industries including food processing, transport and the border force would be given access to LFTs on a daily basis. But this number is tiny. I challenge the government as to why GPs, pharmacists and teachers haven't been deemed critical enough to receive daily tests. I didn't get a satisfactory answer, so it's hard to see how the government intends to keep these vital services running in the weeks ahead. Nonetheless, as we start a new year, it does feel as though there may be light at the end of the tunnel. If we can get more people boosted now, maintain a regular booster programme and work on vaccinating the world, we may be able to make lockdowns a thing of the past. We just have to get past this wave first.
My next article is about how supermarkets are supporting a local hospice. This year, Rennygrove Hospice Care has been chosen as one of the Co-op's local causes, and its Children's Hospice at Home service will also receive support from Morrison's through a new charity partnership with Together for Short Lives. Co-op shoppers can choose to support Rennygrove through its membership scheme. When members buy selected Co-op products, they receive 2 pence from every £1 spent into their membership account, and the Co-op donates the same amount to their chosen local cause. Rennygrove will use all funds raised through the Co-op partnership for its bereavement support programme. As well as flexible support for patients and families, the charity also runs weekly support group sessions for recently bereaved adults. Facilitated by a qualified counsellor and a listening volunteer, the support groups also host speakers with specific areas of expertise such as nutrition, sleep and finance. Head of Family Support Services at Rennygrove, Lisa Jackson, explained, "When a person grieves, talking about and sharing feelings can help. Our support groups bring together recently bereaved people in similar situations to share their experiences, learn coping techniques and support each other." Rennygrove's Children's Service will also receive support from local Morrison stores this year. In a recent colleague vote, Together for Short Lives, the only charity supporting all 54 of the UK's children's hospices, was chosen for a 3-year charity partnership, which starts in February 2022 and aims to raise £10 million nationally. Under the partnership, each Morrison's store will be paired with its local children's hospice, who will benefit from the store's fundraising activities. The Children's Hospice at Home service cares for children and young people living with a life-limiting condition in West Harts and Bucks. Providing flexible care tailored to each family's needs, the service helps families enjoy the best quality of life possible and make every moment together matter. Look out in your local Morrison's for details of how you can get involved and support this crucial service. And there's an image here of a hospice at home nurse talking with a family member.
More than £17,000 raised for a family after daughters have emergency hospital treatment. We can breathe. 3 simple words which summed up the overwhelming gratitude expressed by a St Albans family going through a heart-wrenching personal tragedy. Kayleigh Doherty and partner Sam, who live in Bernard's Heath, have been through a month of hell when both their daughters ended up needing emergency hospital treatment after their family contracted COVID. Despite their best efforts, 3-month-old premature baby Evelyn began to show symptoms and deteriorated fast. After a paramedic assessment, they made the decision to drive her to Lister Hospital, where she began having seizures and was sedated and placed on a ventilator. A team from Great Ormond Street rushed to help and spent 2 hours stabilising Evelyn before driving them to a specialist intensive care team at Addenbrooke's Hospital in Cambridge. Kay explained, "After three of the most horrific and tortuous days of our lives, Evelyn was extubated and breathing independently. We thought we could breathe a sigh of relief, but little did we know that the worst was yet to come. My 11-year-old daughter, Chloe, had also been COVID symptomatic and returned a negative PCR. The day after Evelyn was removed from her ventilator, Chloe's eye suddenly swelled shut and we brought her to A&E after advice from 111. A CT scan showed that her sinus infection had entered the cavity around her brain and she was in severe danger, so she was blue-lighted to Addenbrooke's and underwent an 8-hour operation with world-class surgeons from neurology, ENT, ophthalmology and paediatric all working on her. Having two children in intensive care with unrelated issues is unfathomable. We naively thought it couldn't possibly get any worse. At 12 a.m. on December the 21st, baby Evelyn's hospital monitor sounded. We jumped up to find that she wasn't breathing, was stiff and was deathly pale. As my partner picked her up, she flatlined. Thanks to the efforts of the incredibly fast medical team, Evelyn was brought back with CPR in just under 3 minutes. We lost her a further 3 times throughout the night. The sound of the emergency alarms ringing throughout the hospital corridors over and over again will never leave us. Evelyn remains in hospital, but Chloe was discharged on Christmas Eve. She now faces up to 12 weeks of daily IV antibiotics at Lister Hospital through a new PICC line installed in her arm. Due to our need to be with the girls, we had to close our online business down over the busiest season of the year and have been unable to take any wages. This, coupled with the huge expenses we're incurring daily, has made a tough situation even harder to bear. Kay reached out to Karen Snook, founder of Facebook group St Albans Mums, begging for help. "We've always been too proud to ask for help, but right now we're sinking further and further into a financial abyss. And as our daily costs have taken all of our savings, parking at 2 hospitals, 130 miles of driving, simple food to keep us going, the nightly panic of working out how we'll afford the next day's expenses is unbearable." The response from St Albans Mums members was overwhelming, with more than £17,000 raised in a matter of days, to which Kay responded, "I'm absolutely blown away by the response and have spent the last 24 hours in a state of sheer, speechless disbelief and a never-ending flow of grateful tears. Because of you, we can now afford the £200 a week worth of diesel we've had to pay to go between both girls. We can grab a quick lunch between hospital appointments without questioning whether our hunger is more important than our overdraft. We can buy the girls some new clothes. We can pay for some private therapy sessions for Chloe, who unfortunately saw her little sister being resuscitated. We can pay a huge chunk of months and months worth of unpaid bills. We can fill up our fridge for the first time in goodness knows how long. Chloe still has 9 weeks of daily IV antibiotics to get through, and sweet little Evelyn is facing a life full of many, many hospital admissions. We're struggling to come to terms with that, but our girls are both still alive, and that's the ultimate gift. Thank you again from the bottom of our hearts." To support Kay and Sam, visit gofund.me/72C6C511.
The next piece has the headline, "New Writers Take Centre Stage in OVO's New Season." New playwrights will take centre stage in OVO's new season at the Maltings Theatre. OVO's new writers' season opens at the St Albans Theatre on February the 1st with The Spiral Path by Andrew Sharp. The season runs to April the 9th and includes 12 plays, 11 new works, plus one rescheduled blockbuster. The programme will wow audiences with an inspirational mix of drama, comedy and music, with multiple casts, solo performances and at least one award-winning reworking of a classic text. OVO Artistic Director Adam Nichols said, "Despite its challenges, the pandemic has been a creatively fertile time for many theatre makers. As we hopefully return to normality, we wanted to provide a platform for the actors, directors and creatives who've been involved in our shows over the past couple of years, who've been developing their own innovative new work. We're therefore very excited about our first new writers season and look forward to forging a new avenue through OVO and showcasing some very impressive work by the next generation of playwrights. Founded and run by its dynamic artistic director Adam Nichols, named on the Stage 100 list 2021, and visionary designer Simon Nicholas, OVO's inaugural new writers season features 11 plays by new and nearly new playwrights. It will also feature a production of Lucy Kirkwood's electric, critically acclaimed Mosquitoes, which has been rescheduled from last year's lockdown cancellation. Mosquitoes can be seen at the Maltings Theatre from February the 22nd to March the 5th for 10 performances. Adam Nichols, who will direct the play, said, "I'm especially delighted to finally programme Lucy Kirkwood's brilliant Mosquitoes, which was cancelled during last year's lockdown." The third production of the new season will be a modern dark comedy, Find a Partner, by Miriam Bataille, in March. This will be followed by Under Electric Candlelight from March the 10th to March the 12th. The season will also include Scissor Sisters, Sniff, Rockstar Prince, Three Sisters, Bantajar, Rachel Hammond's debut play, Joshua and Me, Playing Latinx, and Dinner Theatre.
There will be a special St Albans International Organ Festival concert to start the year. The St Albans International Organ Festival will continue its series of monthly organ concerts in January with a rare performance in the city by David Titterington, its artistic director. David is best known in St Albans as the creative mastermind behind the festival and competition, which presents wide-ranging and exceptionally high-quality music, making it venues around St Albans every other summer. The next organ festival in July 2023 will mark 60 years since its foundation in 1963 by the celebrated St Albans musician Peter Herford. David performs across the globe as well as holding the position of head of organ at the Royal Academy of Music and professor of the University of London. But St Albans music lovers do not often get to hear him in concert. David's organ concert at St Albans Cathedral at 5:30 p.m. on Saturday, January the 22nd, will feature music by George Muvat, J.S. Bach, C.P.E. Bach, Nicolas de Grigny, Jehan Alain, and Peter Eben. The recital will be a fundraiser in support of the festival. Admissions and programmes are free, and donations will be welcome to support future festival activities. Kumi Chui is scheduled to perform at the monthly Saturday concert at the Cathedral on February the 19th. Kumi Chui won the Gold Medal Interpretation Prize in the St Albans International Organ Festival 2019.
Now, of course, with all these artistic articles and reviews in the papers, there's always a very, very long and often very complicated email address. So I thought I'd give you the number for the Cathedral, the St Albans Cathedral box office. Even though the organ concerts are free, you might want to get a bit more information. So I'll tell you that number, 01727 846 126. 01727 846 126. Now, one of the things that I actually forgot to say at the beginning was who I am. Now, I'm sort of not presuming you'll recognise my voice, but anyway, I normally would say, "Hello, this is Rob Pearman," but I completely forgot. I forget something every month. Sometimes it's the name of the piece of music, sometimes it's something else. Well, this week I forgot myself. Anyway, I'm still here. I've been here from the beginning, and I shall be here till the end. Thank you. Now, in case you've forgotten what's coming up next, let me give you the menu all over again very briefly. Next up, we've got the radio listings with John Cushing, and that's followed by the feature on television programmes which are audio described. Then I come back with the events, things that happened in this week, in previous years, centuries, decades. And then two biographies. First of all, Andrea Bocelli, the blind opera singer, and then James Joyce, the Irish novelist. That's followed by In Touch, the BBC Radio 4 programme, which we're allowed to download for you. And then I'm back again with some information about a few famous people whose birthdays also occur this week. That's followed by the repeat of last week's exercise programme, and then we'll say goodbye with the music.
Now for a look at some of this coming week's radio highlights, starting with Saturday, January 15th. Radio 4 at 2:45 broadcasts The Dragon Man. This is one of the dramas that showcases the best of crime fiction from Australia. In the height of the Australian summer, young women are being targeted by a serial killer who deliberately appears to leave cryptic clues for the pursuing detectives. As pressure mounts to solve the case, detectives Shallis and Destry can't find anything to connect the crimes with their only suspect. You may prefer to tune into Radio 3 at the slightly earlier time of 1 o'clock until 3 for Inside Music. In this edition, violinist Tessa Lark, who grew up immersed in both classical music and the bluegrass traditions of her native Kentucky, draws on these influences to play music by Ligeti, Dvorak and Bartok, among others. Radio 4 brings us two interesting programmes in the evening as well. At 7:15, Rethink Population, the Great British Baby Bust. Amjil Rajan and guests look at why British birth rates have declined so much and ask, how will we pay for the health and care needs of our ageing population? Followed at 8 p.m. by Archive on 4, The Great Wall. 50 years after President Nixon's groundbreaking visit to China, historian Rana Mitter considers how relationships between China and the USA fell from this promising start to the confrontational approaches of Trump and Biden. On to Sunday, January 16th. Desert Island Discs on Radio 4 at 11 a.m. In today's programme, author Deborah Levy talks to Lauren Laverne about her life and work and selects her 8 discs. Moving across to Radio 3 at 12 noon, Michael Barclay's guest on Private Passions is one of the most successful businesswomen of the 20th century, Stephanie Shirley. She arrived in Britain in 1939 from Vienna without her parents as one of the 10,000 Jewish children brought by train on the Kinder transport to escape the Nazis. She tells us that my whole life has been driven by that journey, a compelling and very moving story with music by Britten and Bach, among others. Also on Radio 3 a bit later on in the day, 7:30 p.m. till 9, Drama on 3, The Miser by Molière. An all-star cast perform a rumbustious new version of Molière's play of secrets, lies and obsessive greed. The play's less than generous view of humanity is extremely funny, and it makes points that feel as relevant today as they did when they were first performed in 1668. The drama is introduced by actor Toby Jones. On to programmes then that are broadcast at the same time each day of the week, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. So same radio station, same time, every day. Radio 4 at 9:45 a.m, It's Always Summer Somewhere. Musician Felix White reads from his memoir about cricket, grief and life in a rock band. In the first episode, he remembers how he fell in love with sport at his grandparents' house and how he became enchanted with the bowler Phil Tufnell. Later, he deals with family loss and success and failure in the world of pop music. From 1:45 each day on Radio 4 all week, you can hear Nature Bang. Becky Ripley and Emily Knight examine the science behind phenomena in the natural world, starting by wrapping their brains around the neural network of an octopus, which leads them to question the human relationship between mind and body. And Radio 3, from 12 noon all week, each day, Composer of the Week. Donald MacLeod charts the story of Franz Liszt's life, from his birth in 1811 to his death more than 70 years later. paying particular attention to Hungarian influences on his work. On to the rest of the week then, the highlights for each individual day, starting with Monday, January 17th. And Radio 4 Extra, The Admiral Crichton, 3 o'clock. The actors Russell Tovey and David Bannerman star in an adaptation of J.M. Barrie's classic satirical play from 1902. Why not try your skill at separating truth from fiction when David Mitchell hosts The Unbelievable Truth on Radio 4 at 6:30 p.m.? Pit your wits against David's guests in this comedy show as they attempt to discover the untruths that lie within the given facts. And later in the evening on Radio 3 at 10 p.m, Music Matters. Presenter Tom Service looks at a handful of conductors making their mark to learn how they work their magic from the rostrum. There's also news of a new sound installation that looks at the issues of voice loss in singers. Tuesday, 18th, Sherlock Holmes, A Study in Scarlet, Part 1, is broadcast on Radio 4 Extra at 3 o'clock until 4, with Part 2 at the same time on Wednesday. This is classic Holmes mystery by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle and has an excellent cast with Clive Merrison as the famous sleuth and Michael Williams as his loyal companion, Dr. Watson. Radio 4 at 4, in word of mouth, when words fail us, the palliative care specialist Catherine Mannix and the poet Michael Rosen join together to think about those discussions people would rather avoid. For example, how do we respond to someone sharing bad news or raw emotion? How do we listen well? What should we say and not say? It sounds as if there may well be some useful lessons for many of us in this. Now, boxing may not be your favourite sport, but in Joe vs. Max on Radio 4 Extra at 9 p.m, Bonnie Greer, the writer, considers the cultural impact of the June 1938 boxing match between the black American Joe Louis and the German Max Schmeling. The question of how possible or desirable it is to separate sport from politics still resonates today. On to Wednesday, the 19th. Why not cheer up your day with a light-hearted journey into Dip My Brain in Joy on Radio 4 Extra at 11 a.m. The programme celebrates the music and comedy of Neil Innes, who collaborated with Monty Python and founded the Bonzo Dog Doodah Band, a highly original and funny man. Also on Radio 4 Extra at 2:30, Words, 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 in which Sue Perkins, the comedian, explores the house of Dr. Johnson, the compiler of his famous and groundbreaking A Dictionary of the English Language in 1755. Radio 3 at 10 broadcasts Free Thinking, that's 10 p.m. in the evening. Lawrence Scott looks at the long history of paper. Now, paper is one of the world's most versatile products and has endured for more than 2,000 years. But is the paperless society imminent? Listen in and see what you think. Thursday, January 20th, Radio 4 at 9 a.m. Another episode in Our Time. In this endlessly informative series, Melvin Bragg and his academic guests this week tell us about the history of the gold standard. 2 o'clock on Radio 3, and it's the afternoon concert. The story of Romeo and Juliet is its focus, with music from BBC ensembles and around Europe. It includes Prokofiev's ballet music and Bernstein's take on it for West Side Story. And in a fascinating edition of Open Country on Radio 4 at 3, Helen Mark explores the area of Purdon outside Bristol, finding out about its significance in the Second World War and meeting the goats that are helping to preserve the remains of gun placements put there to protect the city from bombing raids. Final day of the week, Friday, January 21st, and Fungi, The New Frontier on Radio 4 at 11 a.m. is our first highlight. Tim Haywood wonders about the chemical compounds of fungi and the research into these compounds that is showing their potential as treatments for addiction, PTSD, anxiety, and even dementia. Radio 4 Extra at 2:30 in There's More Here Than I Thought. The author Kate Moss assesses the fascinating life and work of artist, craftswoman and social reformer Winifred Gill, 1891 to 1981, who corresponded with almost every great artist, writer and poet of the 20th century. And the Classic FM concert with John Suchet at 8 p.m. celebrates the music of Carl Jenkins, one of the most performed living classical composers. A very satisfying conclusion to our listening choices for this week. We do hope you will find something to enjoy, stimulate and entertain you. And as always, may I wish you a peaceful, safe and enjoyable week of radio listening.
TNF Soundings. Features from across the UK.
Hello to you all. Here's John's selection of audio-described television programmes for the week commencing Saturday the 15th and ending Friday the 21st of January 2022. So starting with Saturday the 15th, did you miss Digging for Britain? If so, you can watch episodes 4 and 5 on BBC Two starting at 10 a.m. today. Then at 12:40 p.m. on ITV, James Martin's Great British Adventure continues with James and fellow chef Mark Sargent exploring Kent. At 5:30 on BBC One, Superman and Lois continues with part 6. Clark considers his decision to let Jordan play football. BBC Two goes inside the factory at 6 p.m. Greg Wallace visits the Ercole factory in Buckinghamshire and sees how their Windsor chairs are made. Ant and Dec host their Limitless Win quiz show on ITV at 8:30 p.m. Will Z and his dad Tony dare to continue as they ascend the infinite lolly ladder? Casualties on BBC One at 9:30 p.m. Paige is determined to redeem herself on her first shift in the ED. To end the day, there's a look back at Torville and Dean, a film drama depicting the early life of Jane and Chris and their rise to be Olympic champions. You can see this on ITV3 at 11 p.m. Sunday the 16th of January. Bargain Hunt is on BBC One at 12:15, and today they're in Edinburgh's Royal Highland Centre. The final part of Digging for Britain is repeated at 12 noon on BBC Two. The team find a 3,000-year-old wooden coffin. The film on ITV at 2:15 p.m. is The Borrowers, a fantasy adventure. A family of tiny people live beneath the floor of an old house, but the new occupant is a nasty lawyer. There's another film, but on Channel 4 at 5:45. The Greatest Showman tells the story of P.T. Barnum, who is played in this film by Hugh Jackman. Phileas Fogg is still travelling around the world in 80 days on BBC One at 6:10. The Reform Club learn that the travellers have been cast adrift. This is followed still on One by part 2 of Green Planet. David Attenborough looks at the plants in the world of water. Call the Midwife is on BBC One at 8. Nancy tackles the plight of meth drinkers in Poplar. Also at 8, but on ITV, As the Crow Flies is the next episode of Vera. The detective investigates the death on a coastal path of a teacher. BBC One has part 4 of The Tourist at 9 p.m. With a trail of bodies in his wake, the man uses Helen to ensure he stays alive long enough to discover his identity. Also at 9, but on Channel 4, Sue Perkins takes her big American road trip. Sue travels in a camper van to discover the highs and lows of life on the road. Now look at programmes on at the same time each weekday. The Moment of Proof is on BBC One at 10:45. Today, a spent bullet casing is key to bringing two murderers to justice. BBC One at 11:15 a.m, Homes Under the Hammer. Then still on One at 12:15, Bargain Hunt. Doctors is on BBC One at 1:45 p.m, but isn't transmitted on a Friday. Father Brown is on BBC One each day at 2:15 p.m, except Friday when it's on at 1:45. At 3 p.m, on BBC One, you can escape to the country. Rick Stein's Cornwall continues on BBC Two at 6:30 p.m. And on ITV 3, Foyle's War is being re-shown at 10 p.m. all week. The soaps continue in their regular slots. Looking at programmes on Monday the 17th of January. At 7 p.m. on BBC Two, Tom Kerridge makes a fresh start, proving you're never too young, as his own 3-year-old son helps him create phyllo pastry triangles. There's a new series of Geordie Hospital on Channel 4 at 8, following the NHS staff across Newcastle's hospitals. Today we follow the kidney transplant from Deborah to her sister Kimberly. Another new series on ITV at 8 p.m. is Bradley and Barney Walsh, Breaking Dad. The challenges for Bradley include hanging from the roof of a football stadium in Croatia and diving in the Adriatic Sea. Are you a fan of Emmerdale? Remember Andy Sugden, who went on to win Strictly? Well, he has bought a farm in the Peak District, and Kelvin's big farming adventure on BBC One at 8:30pm follows how he and his family get on restoring the farm to its former glory. Who Do You Think You Are? Delves into the family history of actor and author David Walliams at 9pm on BBC One. Also at 9, but on BBC Two, is Inside Dubai, Playground for the Rich. In this final episode, we see who are the beneficiaries of the relaxation of alcohol and tourist dress codes. Now on to Tuesday the 18th of January. Part 2 of The Wonders of the Border is on ITV at 7:30pm. On his trek along Offa's Dyke, Sean Fletcher visits the Black Mountains and the famous book town of Hay-on-Wye. Holby City is on BBC One at 7:50. The pressures of work prompt Fletch to consider Regina's offer. At 8 on ITV, The Secret Life of Our Pets. Tonight we discover how animals put their intelligence to use. Alternatively, at 8 on ITV3, there's Midsummer Murders, Things That Go Bump in the Night. Barnaby and Scott investigate the murder of an undertaker. A choice at 9, on Channel 4, a new series of 24 hours in A&E, following the events in the A&E unit of St George's Hospital in southwest London. Alternatively, on ITV at 9, Ghislaine, Prince Andrew and the Paedophile, chronicling the case that saw Ghislaine Maxwell guilty of recruiting young girls for paedophile Jeffrey Epstein. She explores how Prince Andrew, who denies any wrongdoing, became caught up in the scandal. Are you a petrol head? Car SOS on Moor 4 at 9pm follows Tim and Fuzz as they restore a Fiat X19 for the 53-year-old Steve who has terminal cancer. On to Wednesday the 19th of January, and starting with The Repair Shop on BBC One at 8pm. On the bench for repair this week are a miniature house rescued from the model village in Cleethorpes, a treasured radio, a cast iron fairground game, and a faded but beautiful Indian painting. Paul O'Grady shows his love of dogs on ITV at 8pm. Also at 8, but on BBC Four, Sam Neill narrates New Zealand, Earth's Mythical Islands, home to hyper-intelligent parrots, snails and constellations of glowworms. Rules of the Game concludes on BBC One at 9pm. As police investigations narrow, Sam must decide whether to pick up where Maya left off. Greg Wallace goes inside the factory at 9pm, looking at the manufacture of Doc Martin boots in the Nottinghamshire factory. Part 2 of The Bay is on ITV at 9. Jen identifies a key witness, but this causes her professional and personal worlds to collide. The final part of Britain's Most Expensive Homes is on Channel 4 at 9, a penthouse in central London at £4.5 million and a Knightsbridge home at £75 million are featured today. Finally, it's the BBC 4 for My Family, The Holocaust and Me, Robert Rinder. The criminal barrister helps some survivors and casualties of the concentration camps retrace their forebears' footsteps. Robert also learns the fate of two of his father's relatives. Part 2 follows at 10pm. On to Thursday the 20th. Dragon's Den continues at 8pm on BBC 1. Activity-filled weekends, a new home delivery app, and a range of homemade soups and stews are products looking for investments in tonight's programme. Channel 4 has The Doghouse at 8pm. Rollo, a playful Staffordshire pup, is exuberant on meeting New Yorkers Nicole and her husband Sam. If you like a drama, Jonathan Creek is on the Drama Channel at 8pm. In The Reconstituted Corpse, a beautician is accused of killing her former lover. It stars Alan Davies and Caroline Quentin. Martin Clunes continues his tour of the islands of the Pacific at 9 on ITV. Clunes climbs a volcano in Vanuatu and meets a tribe who worship Prince Philip. Screw continues on Channel 4 at 9. Lee faces further anxiety due to the lies contained within her birth certificate. Finally to Friday the 21st of January. On BBC Two at 7pm, Monty Don's Adriatic Gardens concludes with Monty on Corfu, where he visits the spectacular garden of naturalist Gerald Durrell and goes on a wildflower trail with his widow. George Clark's Amazing Spaces is on Channel 4 at 8 p.m. George meets a couple from Stockport who have transformed an ambulance into a ski chalet on wheels. And Will Hardy visits Leeds to see Thomas Heatherwick's building that puts nature at its heart. On the Drama Channel at 8 p.m, The Last Detective, in Moonlight, Dangerous investigates the disappearance of a man whose wife seems strangely unconcerned of his whereabouts. Midsummer Murders is on ITV at 8 p.m. In Death by Persuasion, a woman slips away from a Jane Austen reenactment in full costume, only to be stabbed to death in the woods. Barnaby and Winter investigate. In Death in Paradise on BBC One at 9 p.m, a skydiver is murdered in mid-air. The investigation submerges Neville and his team in the cutthroat world of social media. How about ending the week with a film? The Bourne Ultimatum is on ITV at 10 past 11, a spy thriller. Jason Bourne sets off for London to meet a journalist who has revealed a covert CIA operation and might be able to help with Jason's past, but his former employers want to make sure that the meeting never happens. I hope you find something of interest in my selection this week.
TNF Soundings.
Something happens every week, of course. Well, here are some events which happened in this very week in the past. For instance, on the 16th of January 1919, the 18th Amendment to the US Constitution, which prohibited the manufacture, sale or transportation of intoxicating liquors for beverage purposes, was ratified by the requisite number of states. Now, the movement for the prohibition of alcohol began much earlier in the 19th century, when Americans who were concerned about the adverse effects of drinking began to form temperance societies. And by the late 19th century, these groups had become a powerful political force calling for total national abstinence, hence the Prohibition Act being ratified and coming into force in 1919. Despite a vigorous effort by law enforcement agencies, the Act failed to prevent the large-scale distribution of alcoholic beverages. Organised crime flourished. Indeed, it can be said that crime flourished because of the prohibition. And eventually, in 1933, the Act was repealed. Then on the 17th of January 1983, the BBC launched Breakfast Time, the UK's first national breakfast television programme. The presenters wore casual clothes instead of formal suits, in contrast to the regular news broadcasts, and the show featured a mixture of news, politics, and more accessible features, including sport, fashion, and science. The main presenters were Frank Boff in his comfy cardi, together with Selena Scott and Nick Ross. Regular contributors included the astrologer Russell Grant, and health and fitness guru Diana Moran, also known as the Green Goddess, owing to the colour of her leotard. Now, over 200 years earlier, on the 18th of January in 1778, the English explorer Captain James Cook became the first European to travel to the Hawaiian Islands. He sailed past the island of Oahu, landed nearby 2 days later, and named the island group the Sandwich Islands, in honour of John Montagu, the Earl of Sandwich, who was one of Captain Cook's patrons. On the 19th of January 1915, two German Zeppelins dropped bombs on Great Yarmouth and King's Lynn on the east coast of England. Originally invented by a Frenchman, the Zeppelin was a motor-driven rigid airship, which the Germans had made much larger. However, the heavy steel-framed airships were vulnerable to explosion because they were filled with highly flammable hydrogen gas. In fact, during the January 1915 attack, one of the three Zeppelins turned back due to mechanical problems, but the other two airships succeeded in hitting their East Anglian coastal targets, and Britain suffered its first wartime casualties from an air attack. On the 20th of January 2009, in Washington, D.C., Barack Obama was sworn in as the 44th U.S. President. The son of a black father from Kenya and a white mother from Kansas, Obama became the first African American to be elected President of the United States. And while being sworn in, he placed his hand on a Bible held by his wife Michelle, the very same Bible used by Abraham Lincoln during his inauguration. A huge crowd of 1.8 million people filled the National Mall to watch the ceremony, after which Obama attended not only the traditional inauguration luncheon at Statuary Hall, but also a further 10 official inaugural balls that evening. They must have been exhausted by the time they'd finished. On the 21st of January 1976, Concorde made its first commercial flight. The flight left London Heathrow, bound for Bahrain, captained by Norman Todd. Concorde's cruising speed was 1,350 miles per hour. That's more than twice the speed of sound. And a typical London to New York crossing would take just under 3.5 hours, as opposed to about 8 hours for a regular flight. Concorde measured nearly 204 feet in length, and it grew between 6 and 10 inches longer during the flight, owing to the heating of the airframe. It was painted in a specially developed white paint to accommodate these changes and to dissipate the heat generated by supersonic flight. And at the very beginning of the last century, on the 22nd of January 1901, Queen Victoria died at the age of 81 at Osborne House on the Isle of Wight. She was surrounded by her family, including the future king, her son, Edward VII. Victoria's 63-year reign was the longest in British history until our own Queen Elizabeth II. On Victoria's deathbed, she asked for Turi, her Pomeranian dog, to be brought to her. She planned her funeral in advance, and despite spending the previous 40 years dressed in mourning black following her husband Albert's death, she dictated that she would have a white funeral. During her lifetime, Victoria saw 10 prime ministers, 5 archbishops of Canterbury, 6 commanders-in-chief, and 18 US presidents. She also outlived all 9 of her bridesmaids. Now, I checked out the statistics for our own Queen, and she has seen 15 different prime ministers since her accession, the first being Sir Winston Churchill, and several of them having occupied number 10 more than once. Our Queen has also seen 14 US presidents, some of them, of course, for 2 terms of office, and also 7 archbishops of Canterbury. And, of course, as we know, Queen Elizabeth is now in the 70th year of her reign.
TNF Soundings. Features from across the UK.
Hello, it's Tanya here, with a biography of Andrea Bocelli. Andrea Bocelli is one of the best-known international opera singers in the world. He was born on the 22nd of September 1958, although doctors had advised his parents to abort him during the pregnancy as they suspected he would be born with a disability. Thankfully, his parents did not agree to this suggestion, and he has said that it was his mother's determination to give birth to him in the face of medical advice that inspired him to oppose abortion. It was apparent from an early age that Bocelli had a problem with his eyesight. This was diagnosed as congenital glaucoma when he was 5 months old. He became totally blind at the age of 12 following an accident. Whilst playing football, he was hit in the eye by a football and suffered a brain hemorrhage. Doctors tried to save his sight, including using leeches, but were unable to do so. Bocelli has shared his feelings on losing his sight, saying, quote, "This didn't affect in any way my musical training. People may perceive it as my main issue, but it never was and never is." Unquote. He credits his parents with giving him the determination not to give up, acknowledging their courage and faith. Bocelli was born in Tuscany in Italy and spent his childhood on a farm where his family sold farm machinery and produced wine. His family have been crafting classic Italian wines for nearly 300 years, and the brand Bocelli has an international reputation. As a child, he's said to have developed an interest in music from an early age. He started piano lessons at the age of 6 and went on to play a great variety of instruments, including the flute, saxophone, guitar, and drums. His nanny is thought to have given him a record of Corelli singing, which developed an interest in other singers, and by the age of 7, he could identify who was singing and would try and copy them himself. He entered singing competitions, winning for the first time at the age of 14 with O Solo Mio. Initially, after leaving school, he studied law at the University of Pisa and was to go on to practice as a court-appointed lawyer for a year after graduating. His musical abilities enabled him to earn money whilst a student, playing the piano in bars. Bocelli had a lucky break in his musical career in 1992 when an Italian rock star called Zucchero held auditions for tenors to sing his composition, Miserere, to send to Luciano Pavarotti. Pavarotti was very impressed by the demonstration tape, and Bocelli joined him and Zucchero on tour, and Pavarotti and Bocelli together released a recording of the same song, which was very successful in Europe. His success continued as he won competitions and went on to debut in classical concerts. Now his concerts around the world are sellouts and he has sold an estimated 75 million records. His career has been diverse, with worldwide tours and collaborations with other international singers from a variety of musical backgrounds, including British singers Sarah Brightman, Ed Sheeran, and Catherine Jenkins. The recordings he is perhaps most well known for include Perfect Symphony with Ed Sheeran, sung in English and Italian in December 2017. The Prayer with Celine Dion, which was the soundtrack of the film A Quest for Camelot. Time to Say Goodbye with Sarah Brightman. And Nessun Dorma. Bocelli has sung several times for the Pope, but was, in his early adult life, an agnostic. He has said that he rediscovered his faith as a Catholic after reading the works of Leo Tolstoy and famously stated, quote, "I do not believe in the clock without the clockmaker," unquote. Recently, when Italy was in lockdown during the COVID pandemic, Bocelli was asked by the mayor of Milan to sing in the Santa Maria Nascente Cathedral on Easter Sunday in 2020. The cathedral was empty because of the pandemic, apart from the cathedral organist, but the performance was streamed live on YouTube and, within a day, had 28 million viewings. There were 2.8 million peak concurrent viewers, which made it one of the biggest musical live stream performances of all time, and the largest simultaneous audience for a classical live stream in YouTube history. The performance was called Music for Hope. In the same year, he released an album based on the virtues of faith, hope, and charity called Simply Believe. Bocelli has performed at many international sporting events, including recently singing Nessun Dorma at the opening ceremony of UEFA Euro 2020, with a worldwide audience of 350 million. He's also written many books, which are available in Italian and English, with some also available in Braille and large print. Bocelli's net worth is thought to be £30 million, and he has used his wealth and fame to support charitable causes and raise awareness of such issues as world hunger. He and his second wife and manager, Veronica Berti, founded the Andrea Bocelli Foundation in 2011, having seen the devastating effects of the earthquake in Haiti, which impacted so catastrophically on a population that was already poor and suffering. The foundation has supported initiatives both in Italy and overseas to help overcome barriers such as poverty, illiteracy, and distress, and support people to reach their full potential. It has also recently raised money to help hospitals treating COVID patients. Bocelli was presented with the Crystal Award by the World Economic Forum in 2015 in recognition of the charitable work undertaken by the foundation. Bocelli has been honoured with many other awards both internationally and in his home country, including being made a Grand Officer of the Italian Republic, World Music Awards, Classic Brit Awards, and has a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame.
DNF Soundings.
Hello, this is Tanya with a biography of James Joyce, written by Sarah. James Joyce is one of the most well-known, innovative and challenging 20th century writers. His books were controversial and thought-provoking, with experimentation in the use of language and new literary methods. By using the stream of consciousness technique, he enabled readers to understand the, quote, interior monologues and soliloquies, unquote, of his characters, thus experiencing the way that a character is feeling. Joyce lived the greater part of his life abroad in Europe, but the characters he depicted were often drawn from acquaintances and his family at home in Ireland, saying, quote, "For myself, I always write about Dublin, because if I can get to the heart of Dublin, I can get to the heart of all cities in the world. In the particular is contained the universal," unquote. He also drew on the experience of an education in Jesuit establishments to inform characterization in his writing. He suffered ill health and deteriorating eyesight and died aged only 58. But his legacy to literature is immense. He realized the difficulties his work sometimes produced, stating that the complexities of his work, quote, "would keep professors busy for centuries arguing over what was meant, and that's the only way of ensuring one's immortality," unquote. Joyce was born into a Roman Catholic family on the 2nd of February 1882 in Dublin. He was the eldest of 10 surviving siblings. Two others died of typhoid. His father experienced fluctuating fortunes through his work that had an impact on his family life. For example, James had to leave the prestigious Jesuit boarding school, Clongowes-Wood College, at the age of 9 when the family could no longer afford the fees. After leaving, he was initially educated at home until both he and his brother Stanislaus were sent with scholarships to Belvedere College, a Jesuit grammar school in Dublin. He did well at the school but fell out of favour when it became clear that he had abandoned his Roman Catholic faith. Clongowes was immortalised by Joyce in Portrait of a Young Man as an Artist, with the character Stephen Dedalus being physically punished for not doing his schoolwork. Dedalus is recognised as Joyce's alter ego. After finishing school, Joyce went on to study English, French and Italian at University College Dublin and read widely, being influenced by Flaubert, Ben Jonson and Ibsen. He was fluent in several languages and even learned some Norwegian so that he could correspond with Ibsen, whom he greatly admired. He was destined to become a writer himself, having begun at a very young age. Like his father, Joyce was interested in politics. This was the time of the Home Rule movement in Ireland, and at the age of 9 he courted controversy by writing a poem, Er Tú Healy, which was a denunciation of a politician called Tim Healy for abandoning the Irish national politician Charles Stuart Parnell. His father is alleged to have sent a copy of the poem to the Pope, reflecting the close connection of politics to religion at the time. This was a hint of things to come and a commitment to repudiating any form of censorship. Whilst a student at University College Dublin, Joyce famously wrote a negative review of the new playhouse, the Irish Literary Theatre, criticising what he saw as its parochialism. The article was so scathing that he had to publish it himself when his college magazine refused to do so. The editor of the United Irishman wrote an article decrying this form of censorship, thus bringing Joyce to the attention of the wider public. Although impoverished, Joyce was part of the Dublin literary circle. He was perhaps most well known for his novel Ulysses, published in 1922, in which he used episodes of Homer's Odyssey and paralleled them in a variety of literary styles, most notably stream of consciousness. It was immediately banned both in Britain and the United States for its perceived obscene content. Prior to this, he had written Dubliners in 1914, Portrait of an Artist as a Young Man in 1916, and Finnegan's Wake in 1939. Joyce's relationship with religion appeared complex and not always easily understood, with some critics believing that as he grew older, Joyce was more reconciled to the faith he had rejected earlier. But there has been much debate over this. Joyce himself said when asked, "When did you leave the Catholic Church?" cryptically replied, "That's for the Church to say." Joyce met his longtime partner Nora Barnacle in 1903. Although in many ways it seems an unlikely match, she is often described as his muse, and they remained together until his death in 1941. She was very proud of him, but she confided to her sister that he drank too much and wasted too much money. She also felt that his writing was obscure and lacking in sense. They lived together for 27 years, travelled widely, and had two children, Lucia and Giorgio, before marrying in 1931. They'd left Ireland for Europe in 1904, with Joyce initially teaching English and settling for 10 years in Trieste. Over the years, he undertook various ventures to try and raise money, including attempting to become a cinema magnate in Dublin and trying to import Irish tweed to Trieste. In 1920, Joyce and Nora moved to Paris, with Joyce planning to finish Ulysses. He had by this time become well known as an avant-garde writer and was very fortunate in having the support of Harriet Shaw Weaver, a wealthy English feminist whose financial backing enabled him to become a full-time writer. However, it was at this time that Joyce's eyes began to cause him more and more problems. He suffered from anterior uveitis, with 12 eye operations being undertaken in both Paris and Switzerland. He was frequently in significant pain, requiring opiates for relief. There have been some suggestions that his symptoms were consistent with the diagnosis of syphilis. Joyce wore an eye patch and would write on large sheets of white paper with a red crayon. He and Nora remained in Paris for 20 years, leaving to live in Switzerland following the Nazi occupation of France. With the help of his contacts, he was able to ensure 16 Jews escaped at the same time. Joyce died in 1941 from a perforated duodenal ulcer, just a month short of his 59th birthday. He is buried in Zurich, and his grave attracts many visitors. He is commemorated every year on the 16th of June in Dublin and elsewhere in an event known as Bloom's Day, Leopold Bloom being the protagonist in Ulysses.
DNF Soundings.
Here are some well-known people whose birth dates fall this week. If you remember, we started looking at famous events in history in this very week of January with the era of Prohibition. Well, it was on the 17th of January that Al Capone was born in 1899. Sometimes known by the nickname Scarface, Capone was an American gangster and businessman who attained notoriety during the Prohibition era as the co-founder and boss of the Chicago Outfit. His seven-year reign as a crime boss ended when he went to prison at the age of 33, not for murder or gangsterism or for being a hoodlum, but for tax evasion. Those offences got him a sentence of 11 years, although in fact he died before he finished the sentence. The 18th of January in 1955 is the birth date of Kevin Costner, the American actor, filmmaker and musician. In 1987, he became the biggest movie star in Hollywood with his starring roles in The Untouchables and No Way Out, though the one I personally recall most is Dancing with Wolves. On the 19th of January in 1946, it was the turn of Dolly Parton to have a birthday. The American singer, songwriter, multi-instrumentalist, actress, author, businesswoman and humanitarian, known primarily for her work in country music. After achieving success as a songwriter for others, Parton made her album debut in 1967 with Hello, I'm Dolly, which led to success during the remainder of the 1960s. The 20th of January 1971 is the birthday of Gary Barlow, OBE, the lead singer of the British pop group Take That. Now, Barlow is one of the UK's most successful songwriters, having written 13 number one singles, and he's even become an actor. On the 21st of January in 1905, Christian Dior was born, the French fashion designer best known, of course, as the founder of one of the world's top fashion houses. And finally, on the 22nd of January in 1940, Sir John Hurt, CBE, an English actor whose career spanned over five decades, was born. He came to prominence in the film A Man for All Seasons and won his first BAFTA in the television film The Naked Civil Servant.
Here's episode 6 of the series on accessible exercise. Please do exercise caution if you attempt anything.
TNF Soundings. Features from across the UK.
Hello everyone, this is 10 Today, a 10-minute set of exercises to do at home to help keep yourself active. Before we get to today's presenter, a couple of housekeeping points to note. The 10 Today project is funded by the Big Lottery and Sport England, and when you're doing the exercises, it's important that you don't push yourself too far, and by taking part, you agree to 10 Today's terms and conditions. You can read these terms and conditions at tnflink.uk/10T, and the 10T is the digit 1, the digit 0, and the letter T. And please remember that you agree to take part at your own risk. Today's exercises are brought to you by Peter, and here he is.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to 10 Today, broadcast number 6, where we focus on stretching. This is a short 10-minute physical activity routine which will get you moving and stretching. It's great for your health, including improving your balance and building up your strength. Just take it at your own pace. There are plenty of options. If remaining seated, at least to begin with, it will be ideal if you can use a hard chair so that you can sit upright, preferably without arms, which can get in the way of some exercises. We'll start with your feet flat on the floor. Okay. If you are standing up, just step your feet hip-width apart. Relax your shoulders and stand up nice and tall. Take a couple of deep breaths. If you're sitting down, place both feet firmly on the floor. Keep your back straight, relax your shoulders and take a couple of deep breaths. In, out. So, we are going to start with a calf stretch, so if you're standing, have your feet facing forward and step your right foot out in front of you with your foot flat on the floor and then bend into that right leg, keeping your leg straight. Put your hands on your right thigh and hold this position, feeling that stretch. in the back of your leg. If you're sitting, straighten out your right leg and place your heel on the floor so your toes are pointing upwards, keeping your left leg bent with your foot flat on the floor, and put your hands on your right thigh and lean forward. You should feel that nice stretch in your straight leg. The important thing about stretching is that when you feel the muscles start to stretch, just hold it there. Don't take it any further. So hold that stretch for 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Now we are going to swap legs. So if you're standing with your feet facing forward, step forward your left foot and bend into that left leg, keeping your back straight. The weight should be on the left foot. And if you're sitting, straighten out your left leg and put your heel on the floor with your toes pointing up, and then keep your right leg bent. Put your hands on your bent thigh and lean your chest slightly forward into the stretch. You should feel that nice stretch in your straight leg. Hold for 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Next, we're going to do a hamstring stretch. Feet facing forward, step forward with your right foot, placing your foot out in front of you with your foot flat on the floor. Keep this leg straight, then bend your left leg and put your hands on your hips and just lean the chest forward gently. Remember to keep your back straight. Whether you're sitting or standing, you should feel a nice stretch down the back of your leg. Hold for 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Then return to an upright position and swap your legs. So this time, step forward with your left foot, placing your foot out in front of you, with your foot flat on the floor, then bend your right leg and just lean forward gently. Again, feeling that nice long stretch. Hold for 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Next up, we have a few head and neck stretches. Starting with the head tilt forward, tilt your head gently forward as if you're nodding. Nice and slowly, and then return upright and just do that a couple more times. So nodding nice and slowly downwards and return upright. Keep going slowly. So that should feel a nice stretch in your neck. And the final neck stretch, head rotation. Turn your head to the right slowly, as if you're looking over your right shoulder, then return to middle, then turn your head to the left slowly, as if you're looking over your left shoulder. And just keep going, looking from left to right, slowly feeling that nice stretch in your neck. So for this next one, bend your right arm and bend it over your head so your hand is touching your back, like you're going to scratch your back. And your elbow is next to your ear. With your other hand, press gently on your elbow and feel that nice stretch in your arm. Hold for 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Then release. Then do the same on the other side, so bending your arm over your head with your hand on your back and placing your other hand on your elbow and pressing gently, feeling that nice stretch down your arm. Hold for 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Now we have the side stretch. Stand or sit up tall. Raise your right arm high with your palm facing up, then lean slightly over to your left side, nice and slowly, feeling that stretch all along your right side. Try to keep your body straight and hold for 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Now return back to the centre, lean your left hand over and feel that stretch all the way down your left side and hold for 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. So the next one is a chest stretch. So open out both your arms to the side so that your chest sticks out a little and you can feel a nice stretch all the way across your chest. Just a little bit like a long-lost friend is coming towards you and you are going to give them one big hug. So with your arms open wide, feeling that stretch across your chest. Keep holding here for 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Next up is a trunk rotation. What we mean by your trunk is your upper body. Stand or sit up tall, straight back. Place your hands on your hips and slowly look to your left, feeling your upper body rotate. So bringing the right shoulder in front and return gently to center and then slowly look to the right, bringing the left shoulder in front, feeling your upper body rotate. Now keep going a few more times, nice and slowly. Great work, everyone. If you're standing, remember to keep your knees soft. And the final stretch, hugging a tree. Just hold your arms out in front of you, just like you are hugging a tree, directly in front of you. Your arms form a nice circle in front, and then cup your hands, putting one hand in front of the other, and push your hands together, feeling that nice stretch across your shoulders and arms. Hold for 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Now sit up or stand up and return to that nice relaxed posture we had at the beginning. Brilliant. So that's the end of the stretching session. I hope you feel loose and revitalized. Just to finish off, shake it out. So just shake those arms and hands, then legs and feet. Great work, everybody. Doing 10 today just 3 times a week can have a great health benefit. It's fun and you simply feel better. So keep going.
TNS Soundings.
Thanks to all those who've participated in this programme and made it possible. Of course, I don't know them all by name because some of them are working with other talking newspapers in different parts of the country. But it's great to have such a mix of people involved. Just before I go, can I just remind you to not forget to return the wallets as soon as you finish with each programme. Just makes it easier for us to have them earlier rather than late in the month. Helps us to keep the whole shebang rolling. Right, I'm going to say thank you for listening. Thank you for being with us. And I hope you've got some pleasure out of the programme. If not out of all of it, at least out of some of it. Next week, Bill will be with you with the January edition of Red Saturn. I'm glad to say he's recovered from being a little ill early last month. I'll be back next month with the February edition of Saturn. And in the meantime, I hope you cope with the weather, whatever it brings us. Let's hope there's some blue skies. And I hope that you stay well and keep clear of COVID as it gradually, we hope, fingers crossed, seems to disappear over the horizon. And then one day soon, we can get back to more normal life. Take care. Bye-bye.